Good afternoon. Welcome to the Webinar Wednesday. This afternoon, we have the first in a series of webinars for our 2019-2020 year. My name is Honor Feedy, and I'm with NAESP. I'm the professional learning coordinator here at NAESP, and I'll be helping with supporting our speaker today. We're so glad that you've joined us. Today's topic is entitled Empowering Kids to Rise Above Technology Addiction. It's a great topic, and with us is Lisa Strohman, PhD, JD, and the founder and director of Digital Citizens Academy. She's one of the foremost experts in the field of addiction, and she'll be addressing the global issue of technology addiction with students. She has worked in addiction and brain research for Congress, the FBI, and most recently as an attorney and clinical psychologist. Lisa, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with our audience today. We're so glad to have you. We hope that everybody who's listening in will use the chat box on your panel to write in your questions as we go through today's presentation. And I've written you a note asking you to please download today's presentation from our website at www.naesp.com/webinars. So Lisa, please share with us what you have to share.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here, and thank you all for taking time out of your busy day to come in and listen. This is definitely a passion of mine and something I've been talking about for almost two decades now. So from the very beginning, we've talked about kind of the psychology of technology and specifically working with the schools over the past 20 years, just dealing with how it's impacting your students. So again, feel free to jump into the chat box if you have questions or anything that I can help with on that end as well. So I want to start out and say that I really feel like technology shouldn't really be the one that we totally blame in the situation of being the call of all evils, let's say, because even though technology has ridiculous products like the ones that you see here, because that is actually an iPotty that exists that people buy in order to do potty training and put technology in it. All of these devices, when you go through it, are things that we have parents purchasing for their kids. And so I would suggest or think that what we're seeing in the educational realm, particularly a lot of the kinders and first grade teachers that I talk with, is that they feel like they definitely have a different kid in their hands. And when they get older, and they've been in school a little bit longer, and then they have more access to devices, then you definitely see it change. But I would also argue that as adults, and as you can see in these pictures, we also are the leaders in this as parents, not so much in education, but as parents, where we see them using their technology so much that they're not engaging with their kids. And so again, is it actually the technology, or is it the way that we're using it? So here's a poll. I know Honor's going to help me with this. Oh, this is the question that's up on the poll is a different question. So do you have the resources to help students with issues related to their increased access to personal devices? This is another question that I am interested in hearing about too, but you as a school, do you feel like you have the financial, the manpower, but any resources to really help with the fact that your kids are spending more and more time online?
And it looks like 29% said yes to the resources to help students related to increased access, and 71% said no, they don't have the resources to help students with issues related to their increased access.
Got it. Well, so for me, that's really helpful, and again, we'll get into the other questions too, but like I certainly think that there's a really easy way to get you better resources, and that's what this talk is all about in terms of it not being something that is challenging. If you understand technology as really more of a gateway into these worlds and like in figuring out the best way to spend your time, and again, that's where I spend all my time, is trying to figure out ways to give and help and give back into the community, certainly. So I want to start a little bit about how kids get to where they are and where your world starts and where it kind of leads into and why I think that it gets kind of sticky. You know, educational medias are amazing. We've got Think Central and Google and AR programs and Imagine Math and Achieve 3000, and I'm sure you have a dozen other educational medias that you use. And so I think that the big push that I saw over the last 10 years is that the higher ups want more technology infused into the classroom because it will improve technology into or technology will improve like scores and performance and things like that. And so I think ultimately it does absolutely give you tools that can help a classroom that might have kids in the bottom level and kids in the top and create an equalizer in that situation. But what I think we didn't think about is how those educational medias made kids very adept and able to go into social media platforms very quickly with that same sort of skill set and comfort when we don't necessarily have parents. So on here we have Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat. If you don't recognize the Solo Cup, that is House Party, which allows 8 people to go into a room at one time. And then TikTok, which is the old Musical.ly, and it's a play singing video platform. And then Omegle, which literally talks about kids being able to go out and meet strangers, and it kind of does a chat roulette sort of situation. So what I see with kids is that they are now the largest consumer group in history that has control over this technology world. They don't really know it. They don't know that they're the ones that are able to make the decisions, and they go onto these platforms that literally, in my opinion, lift their data and record and steal from them some of those innocent moments that they might be wanting to do with friends online. I don't think the platforms created that for evilness, but again, my background with the FBI and working with task force and internet crimes units, these are the areas that predators go. And they're the areas where kids get trafficked, and they're the areas that kids get groomed in order to steal photos and manipulate them in certain ways. And so what was really ultimately a good thing, you know, takes a turn. And so you have these unintended consequences of these really lovely children that used to play and have fun and smile and do things out in the real world attached into these devices for various reasons, because the industry knows how to make them very sticky and make them very alluring to kids. And so from my area of psychology and looking at how technology influences it, I see that it really starts where you're looking at where kids enter it. So let's do a quick overview. The average age of first personal device, I usually ask this interactively, and throw candy up to the people that get closest. But in the United States, we have at the age of 6, kids are now getting their own personal device. And so this is what's a little bit terrifying to me when we look at the science a little bit, meaning that they feel they own it. The average percentage of students with a cell phone by middle school is now 91%, which more than half, approximately asking on the, depending on the research you look at, between 65 and 72% have smartphones. So by the time you're getting into that middle school area where that full development, you know, with puberty and all of these things are happening, sprinkling in a little testosterone or estrogen, they're getting a device that essentially connects them to the world, into these platforms. You can imagine how much more difficult it is for them, and that's right off of this elementary school years that they're coming off of. This may shock some of the elementary school principals, but the average age of first porn viewing in the United States is 8, and average chronic use begins at 11. Typically, this really equates with the fact that by second grade, we are putting them into areas where they're doing research projects and having to access that global entity online. And so those industries, which are $100 billion industry to date, go after them in ways that we innocently wouldn't think of. So my 8-year-old in second grade did a report on Carl Lewis, started looking him up as who he was going to do, and at the bottom of the computer screen, a banner pops up with a naked girl, and instead of clicking it, he says, "Mom, they tried to trick me like you said they would," right? So again, I had already, obviously because I do this, had that conversation with him, but I would say 99% of parents at age 8 are not having a conversation about pornography with their parents. So again, think about the educational impact. If you've got an 8 to 5th grader or 2nd grader to 5th grader regularly viewing or looking or thinking about pornography, and whether or not academically they're going to stay focused. And then if you look at the percent increase in social media related suicides, there's a 200% increase in teen girls, that's 10 to 14, and a 15% increase in boys, again, 10 to 14, and that's from the release of the smartphone in 2006 to 2016, or the data from the CDC and Dr. Mercy, who I work with. So we're seeing this increased risk with these kids that are getting early on access, and it's not just, in my opinion, an identity crisis that they're struggling with and a loss of that childhood ebbing away, but it really is more of an online identity issue with them, is who are they trying to become and be exposed to online. And as that comes to fruition, we tend to see that there's like a crisis on them. And so when you look at the emotional toll that that takes, you know, we've got kids as young as 8 that are taking their lives. And kids that are online that, you know, Michelle Carter is a perfect example, if you haven't heard of that case, where she convinced her boyfriend to stay in the car and take his own life, which created legal situations online. So it doesn't matter, the fact that she was underage doesn't matter that she was held responsible for that situation in that case, for what she put online. So maybe a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old, as they're starting to like go online with their first device and practicing and pretending, are going to be opening themselves up for a painful situation. And so when you look at these cases of where now you've got social media and you have live streaming capabilities, even 2 years ago, we had the first case of a 12-year-old who's in sixth grade, who had had chronic online bullying. And again, in this case, I think that the district ended up paying out over $600,000 to the family in a $4 million lawsuit that kept them going at least almost 2 years, 19 months I think it took. But again, is it the responsibility of the school? In my opinion, no. But in the respect that the online bullying continues into those platforms or those times that involve other students, the administrative time on your end is incredibly high, and I recognize that and try to help whenever I can. And then I talk a little bit about what it is that, you know, these kids look like, and it's not my kid, and I try to bring in pictures. There's thousands of them. Of what these kids look like. And they're decent, good kids that are walking campus every day, that have this secret, that they feel like that they can't share, because they feel like every kid that they're the only one. But I think, you know, I would love it if anybody wanted to like throw in a comment into the chat box about whether or not you've dealt with some of these issues on your own. But I suspect that the people on the call certainly have had some exposure and some concern or worry in this area, because we don't always know what's going on with those kids. But has anyone out there, if you wanted to throw it into the chat box, I can see it on the right-hand side, has anybody out there dealt with a situation where a teacher has come to you, or a student directly, or a parent, that has made you worry for your district or your school, that there might be a situation in that? And I'll give you just a minute to like feed the chat box if you want to weigh in.
Great. So please use your chat box and answer the question. And as people are writing in, you deal a lot with this on a daily basis, right? Do you work with schools and districts on this issue?
So I speak nationally on this. I go in and talk to the kids, and I do a lot of professional education development for the school districts. I also have a private practice that I see kids in, and I think that probably the pulse of what's happening with kids is mostly because of that, is because I have this unique ability to also have these private sessions where I can get some information from them.
It's fascinating, your research on that. So Gregory has put in something. We had fifth graders leaving untraceable messages to each other using comments on Google Docs. Once they resolve the comment, it disappears, leaving no trace.
Yeah, which is a common issue. We had a district that's, thanks for that, Greg, that created a Google Doc and started uploading pictures of kids that were in uncompromising positions in bathrooms. And so that started trending. And as you can imagine, if you didn't know the Google Doc exists, then you didn't know that your picture was on there. And so there was a huge amount of issues in terms of like, how do we manage that from a standpoint of what's allowed and not allowed, besides locking down the bathrooms with, you know, armed guards. And again, kids left to their own devices. And to me, Google Docs have been the bane of some schools' existence because of the way that they can share and erase things in that manner. So.
Wow. And Joe writes, all the time, there's a disconnect regarding expectations of social media use. Bridging the gap and getting parents and kids to understand is difficult.
Thanks for that, Joe. I really appreciate that validation because, like I said, I've been doing this for so long, and I really do feel like the parents don't understand how they can support the schools, and the schools don't really know how to communicate with the parents and creating those policies and those cell phone rules and how do you get around the kids that are going to, you know, bring burner phones and things like that. But there definitely is a disconnect of how that social media is impacting kids.
One last comment from Khan. He says, hi, my name is Khan Mari. I work as an assistant vice president in high school. My question is, what measures can be taken by school administrators? And I'm assuming with regard to this issue, what suggestions do you have?
Right. I think there's a lot of things that you can do in terms of like parent education. And that's some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about in just a second. But like the parent education piece of getting them on board to require them to have some sort of skin in the game. So I've got some school districts that are mandating that the parents go through a training. It doesn't have to be Digital Citizen Academy, but like it should be some training whereby the school can actually say, we've provided you with tools and have a metric on board as a school that you can say you have or you haven't done that. And I think that that's the biggest part that I tried to solve in the beginning was how do we create accountability for the schools, for the parent side of things, because I think that parents, you know, really want to believe that their kids are good and they are good kids. I mean, look at the kids in this picture. They're happy and they're sweet and they're charming, but when you put the amount of hate and difficulty and cyberbullying that occurs, it really is kind of a challenge. And what I see from my side is the influence of that and the chronic negativity and, you know, sexting and legal issues and harassment, all of that stuff comes into play. And so what I see in my private practice and what I see when I go out into the field and talk to other teachers, when I'm doing presentations or with even with the kids themselves, that nobody really has come in and said, hey, here's some really good rules around this. And I'm going to talk a little bit towards the end about that. So here's another poll question. Do you see the influence of technology overuse issue that impacts learning? I'm not 100% positive that that's the question that's going to pop up at this point. But honor if you want to do and let them see if they think that that is a direct impact of their learning. Yeah, and I use the term technology overuse because I really do have an issue, maybe as a mom myself with two kids, one just went into middle school and one's still in elementary. I don't like the label addiction, and I think it's unfair for kids to get that label so young in life. But in terms of technology overuse and the impact of technology, I definitely want to get some feedback on whether or not the educators have a different feeling of whether or not it's impacting the learning.
Okay, I'll close the poll and share the results. 82% said yes, they see the impact of technology overuse as an issue that impacts learning. Only 18% said not.
Yeah, so I think that, again, like this goes back to me from a very early age working with the schools, just going out and talking, knew the science behind it. So the technology and how it impacts brain, it's very clear for 20 years now that we know that it impacts the structural and the functional aspects of the brain. And so when we're talking about what that means, it means the emotional processing. So kids aren't able to emotionally regulate the same. They can't have executive attention the way that they used to. So the decision making and cognitive control, those are all the areas that what we see scientifically with increased use of technology. And I will say that that level, and let me clarify that for you. I used to have a nice graphic, but I tried to cut down. It's like a food pyramid. So when I talk about the base of that food pyramid and like Maslow's pyramid of like what we need, those educational, creative, the ability to create documents or papers or content. That's the base and the part that we really know that it's healthy to stay involved in. The top of the pyramid, like the donuts and the junk food, that part's like the social media and these live streaming apps and the stuff like that. So those are the things we're talking about that impact brain structure, that kind of throwaway technology, I would say, that doesn't really benefit them in anything that they do over 3 hours a day, including text messaging, including social media platforms. Anything that isn't creative or cognitively focused does show structural damages in the brain. And so what frustrates me is that we know, for instance, this was from 2013, that if there's a decreased functional brain connectivity in adolescents. We know that we can see that there's brain anatomy alterations associated with social networking. So the more somebody's on social media, we are structurally changing the brain of those kids. And that's a similar micro abnormalities in adolescents. And again, the part that I struggle with is there are no studies out there that we can go and create, because of course no parent is going to sign those kids up and say, yeah, let's put them behind social media for 3 hours and see what happens, or, you know, do that. It's all report in response and moving forward. And a lot of our research, as you can see by some of the people on the authors on these papers, are from other countries. And so we've got a very strong international approach to this. And a lot of the other countries are light years ahead of us, I would argue, in terms of how they're protecting kids and what they're doing for it. But the frustrating part for me is that when we know that gray matter is so vital to kids' development in terms of how they cognitively manage, say, a math problem that has to go from 1, 2, and 3, those steps, and we go in and we look at how they can have an atrophy of that and they can lose that, that's the part that I think from an academic standpoint, it doesn't surprise me that we're losing strides academically, without creating more restrictions and more cohesiveness between the families and the schools on this issue. And then the white matter on the inside is really literally how our brain sends messages. So not to get too nerdy, but you know, if you have a thought with your right hand and you want to send it to your left hand, all of that takes white matter. So if you have a child from an academic standpoint that's trying to take an idea and create it into a project, and they have damage to those areas, which again, like I said, we have gray matter atrophy, meaning that part of the brain that creates and allows us to have novel thoughts is being broken down, and then we have the white matter compromised. It would be as if you are dealing with a child that has a long stretch of highway with 1,000 potholes. And so at what point, if you've got a kid, let's say that's spending 40 hours a week playing Fortnite, and then they come in and they try to perform academically and they hit one pothole and then two potholes and then three potholes, eventually they're going to give up because the road is too bumpy for them. And so then you start to feel those kind of emotional and psychological parts with the kids where they're starting to fail. And that's what breaks my heart, and I know it breaks your heart. And that's where I try to bring the parents in and try to like help them and figure out. And so again, this is where I think it would be good. Yeah.
Lisa, if I could just interrupt for a moment, is this research also, does it have something to do with the parents and adults as well, or is it just changes in adolescents?
That's a great question. I think when you look at the brain development, and my next slide is the issue why it affects all of us. So our brain has plasticity until about 70. So I always tell my father-in-law, I said, well, you're over 70. So, you know, you got to cut back on your tech use now. But for a developing brain for young kids, and when you're seeing it, 5 and 6, remember, is the first age that kids are getting their own personal device. And look at where the gray matter development normally is without any sort of influence. So when you add in technology along that scope and you start to have more and more quote unquote insults or times and issues of where they can damage that gray matter development, that's why I think it's so critical in the younger ages, and why for the elementary school period, like, that's so important to get those that balance in place for them. So that's a great question. We have, again, the second neuronal burst and a really big growth that happens at puberty for kids. But once we lose those connections, and this is the part that I think terrifies people a little bit, but once we lose that connection, so think about a rope and you cut it, that rope never grows back together. So if you need to go from point A to point B, you're going to have to create a new path. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like having to relearn over again. And so that's the part that I, again, from a standpoint of 1,000 miles up and never having taught in an academic setting, but having worked with them, and there's, I've got a ton of teachers that are on my panel that I see on the weekends to try to support. Like they come in and they have challenges with that issue. So that's why it's so big with little kids. So in the neurochemical part, the other part of it is that dopamine pathway. So this is the part that I think a lot of people talk about. And if you haven't seen the TED talk I did, I talk about it a little bit, but I'm going to bring in some of the images here. But here's what it should look like. See that red area? That's a part of the brain that's like super healthy dopamine. That means that when we have somebody show up and flash a smile at us and makes us smile back, right? That's our reward pathway. It can be, you know, based on food, or it can be based on human connection. It can be a lot of things, but that dopamine is what really kind of elicits that happiness and that ability to respond. When you put in a substance, whether it's alcohol, drugs, nicotine, in this situation, I gave an example of meth, look at what happens to that dopamine. So it completely almost dissipates, because what happens is if the brain is so flooded with all of this intense, in this situation, drug, those dopamine receptors just shut down and they close off. And so what happens is like a person like who's on drugs has to go seek out more and more and more chronically in order to have that happy feeling again. So you start losing the ability to be happy. And sadly, this is an updated slide, so it's a more recent imaging, so it looks a little bit different. But the same thing with that dopamine is you can see it's not that nice, healthy oblong. And this is a scan from a 19-year-old who had spent 6 hours a day either gaming in social media or looking at pornography. So that was kind of the group of boys that they did this research on. So I pulled just one of the scans to show that you have the same level of down regulation of that dopamine, which just means that they can't be as happy anymore. They're less affable as people, because they have that chronic input of something that makes them happy that we don't get in the real world when we're not online.
So Lisa, is there a length that they have done it? Like, is it just after like one use in social media, or is it after,
you know, 3 hours?
Three hours for 5 days, or how long do they have to have been doing that before it starts really showing up?
That's a great question. It's typically cumulative, but what we see is that you start to see these neurochemical and structural changes even after the first day of that, of being online for 3 hours. You're going to see minor effect. And again, like, remember that the brain is plastic, and particularly with younger kids, it can rebound. And so we can get some of those, specifically the neurochemical parts back. And if it's pre-adolescent, we're going to get a new neuronal growth, so we can have the structural parts back. But after puberty, you're going to see that chronic use start to basically degrade over and over. And you're looking at, typically in the elementary school age, you're looking at kids that are chronically online, either gaming or on social media, for about 6 hours a day right now in the U.S.
Thank you. That's awful.
So we're causing, and again, this is where, you know, it's, you know, you don't want to be the person who's running around calling Chicken Little, but we definitely are seeing, again, those social media, gaming, pornography, the parts that are bad for us, we're using it far too much. And so it's not a surprise to me. And I, again, from the educational standpoint, I'm sure it's not a surprise to you knowing, but you're getting kids that are coming on board that need more support for their mental health or that depression or anxiety, because we've never seen in history a more unhinged population coming in to elementary school, let alone middle school and high school. But our elementary school kiddos that are coming in are desperate, and we've got families breaking up and parents that are spending more and more time online. And so that really, that disconnect and that break isn't surprising to me. And we already did the poll question about adequate resources, so I'm going ahead and skip that one. But I wanted to say that if you wanted to put into your chat box or whatever, like, the solution to me, what I'd love to hear from you is, have you tried any solutions on board, or have you even looked at it in this way? Because I'd love to hear if there's anything on your end, about what you've tried or haven't tried. Because, from my standpoint in talking to these schools and going, sometimes in the international area as well, is that the solutions that are being tried haven't really specifically helped everyone yet. And so if you could jump onto the chat box and tell me if you've tried anything to address this issue, and if you have, what it is, and whether or not you felt it was helpful or sustainable, maybe.
Robin asked, besides educators sharing this information with parents and grandparents, I see the importance of sharing screen time at school with caregivers so that the total screen time can be monitored. This includes before and after school programs.
I think that, Robin, that's a great point to bring up, because I think that parents, again, when we take our kids off to school, we know that they're going to have certain specials or certain time on those technologies. But if we have a policy, and this goes back to what are the things that you can do, one of the things I think that I feel very strongly is what is it as a district or as a school that you can do to have a policy in place so that all of your teachers are on the same page with that? Because, you know, we have downtime with our kids, and it's really easy to allow them to jump onto technology to kind of fill that time. And, you know, with cool math and some of those fun things that they can do that are educationally based, you know, those are kind of those things that, is it count against them, or is it whatever, or is it qualitative, like, educational content? Regardless, parents should actually know, so that when they get home at the end of the day, how much time that they should, like, expect their kids to be on or not on the computer. So that's a great question over devices.
Good comment. Joe writes, re-engaging with young people and being intentional regarding alternative activities is good. Kids need balance. Adults' lives have become so busy that tech has become a substitute.
So very true. And like I said, I think that us trying to figure out how we balance our own lives and trying to manage some work and kids and be creative at the same time is always a challenge, particularly, again, if you've got a child who spends 4 to 7 hours a night once they get home attached to their devices. When they come into a school environment, that's going to be their norm. And again, that goes back to the parents and the educators, like, working together and talking with one another.
And Gregory writes, is there any data as to whether one-to-one schools have more problems with students and internet addiction and or social media bullying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we see is is it different? It's still trauma. What we see is, like, a primary trauma, if you're having the one-to-one, if I'm getting the question right, but a one-to-one, like, bullying in real life versus social media bullying. Is that the question? Is data whether or not one-to-one schools? One-to-one schools meaning they have their own devices. Sorry, Greg. I had questions popping up in two separate sections. No, that's interesting. There has not been a lot of research that's been released that the one-to-one device schools have more of an issue, than other schools. And my intuition would be, and maybe you guys could weigh in, but my intuition is when you have a one-to-one device school, there's probably a policy in place and the curriculum is based around that, maybe a little bit more effectively than a school that is using them as a special that's coming in or hasn't really thought to take a special about having a cell phone on a kid's desk and using it infrequently for certain things that are important. So that's a great question. And certainly can happy to look that up if you want to write me. I can send you some money.
Carol writes the question, is there a difference of 6 hours of social media usage combined within the technology usage as a learning tool as harmful?
Yeah, there's definitely, again, that goes back to that sticky wicket of, like, what's good, healthy usage and not. So if you were using social media as a learning tool, say, For instance, if we're using Instagram to connect to another school, let's say in Africa or another country, and we're creating, you know, a sort of global educational opportunity for our kids in that, that would be something, again, because you're facilitating as an educator, and I'm just using it as an example, wouldn't be something that I would count against it, because it's not where they're going in and interfacing with like peer strangers without an educational purpose or reasoning behind it. So I hope that helps answer that question.
That's good. I have a question for the audience before we go on. You mentioned it briefly, Lisa. If you could write in the chat box, how many of you all right now have a district policy on the social media use? How many of you actually have a district policy around that? Because Lisa, you said you didn't think there was many out there. I just am curious about our audience, whether they know of any.
Most schools tend to have tech policies. I don't know about social media. So I guess that would be the differential that I would ask of that. So, you know, I think every single school has a technology policy and IT, but in terms of, and Joe says that he has one, but the issue of whether or not there's a social media policy in the school, because that's, of course, the famous argument by, you know, Zuckerberg and any of the social media platforms, is that they're just a platform. They're not responsible for the conduct or the content that's put upon them. And so I think from a school standpoint, what are you doing to maybe protect yourself in terms of like your policy on we do or we don't, you know, want to engage or allow social media use with the students on campus or whatever. And that might be something that, you know, putting or adding into your tech policies would be helpful, at least to put the parents on warning that they're doing, that you're doing something to kind of address and recognize that this is an issue that the kids are facing.
Right.
So let me give you some optimism and hope, because we know that there's like some really simple solutions at work. This has been my passion. Dr. Conrad, who's on, knows how much this means to me. But if we give the kids the tools and we empower them to be the leaders in the space, I promise you they make good decisions. The problem I have seen is that we can talk to the students independently, or I can talk to the teachers independently, or I can talk to even the parents independently. But unless we all know that we're playing and having the same education about the why behind it's good or bad or how we use it, I've seen that without the triangulation of those groups, we don't get somewhere. So with education and preventive education, meaning we don't wait until there's a crisis on campus, but we go in and we say, hey, here's like the nuts and bolts of X. We do see kids making different choices. We also created a diversion program, because the one thing, which is basically a restorative justice model of how do you handle four kiddos that make that mistake without making them feel guilty, shame, hurt, that they can't ever come back. If you heard me talk 15 years ago, I would say whatever you put online is public and it's permanent. I don't say that anymore, because it's not helpful to the kids. It's also not true with some of the new laws that are coming up. There's certain ways that we can help kids get stuff off. But how do we really divert them from doing that again? And how do we create leaders, which we've created a peer program, but how do we create leaders on campus? So how do we take our sixth graders, our fifth and sixth graders, and make them peer mentors, just like the Reading Buddy program, right? How do we take those sixth graders and have them have a conversation with the first and second graders and say, you know what, maybe you shouldn't be looking to get your first device at six, and maybe you should just play on the playground and be happy little kids? Because that's what the fifth and sixth graders say to me. They said, I wish somebody would have told me that the minute I got a phone that I was going to have to be responsible for X, whether it's answering people, taking care of friends, all of the different issues that happen when they get their first device, and how do they help other kiddos? Because as much as I love going out and talking about this, I certainly can't be everywhere at every moment. And I think kids tend to be the best leaders. And so I'm really proud of the peer program. And then again, I would say that community partnership, right, implementing those community-based rules where everybody's on the same page, the school, the parents, and the kiddos, and utilizing your PTO or your PTA to maybe to help build that for you. We've worked with multiple PTOs and Kiwanis, university partners are a great resource if you haven't reached out into your community out that way, because they have the incentive of wanting to get your kiddos later in life and put their brand in front of them. So getting them to sponsor programming that can come in to do some of the work, I've seen work really well. And then of course your youth organizations, right? That's a really good way your kids to get involved in it. So if you have a program on campus or things like that, that you can like build into the solution of having balance with your technology, that's a great way. So let me give you a little bit of background. So here's why I say that there's hope. This is a graph, and let me walk you through it, of where the red bar represents kind of overall discipline issues on one campus, 980 students. And so in 2011 and 2012, you had about 40% of those incidents were related to technology. Then in 2012, 50% of those issues that the administrators were dealing with were related to technology. And then 2013, 2014, if we had more time, I would say I'd have you guess, but this is getting a new principal on board. And so the rules really changed and they address things differently. And so the overall incidents came down, and I happen to know the principal who's ex-military and didn't tolerate quite as much as the other principal, I think. But they had a culture shift that year. But as you can see, still increasing is the technology-related referrals. So they had 58% that year of all of their administrative time and resources went to technology. In 2014, it went up to 71%, right? The honeymoon's over. So 2015, 2016, 72%. So that technology-related infractions and administrative time that they were dealing with was related to technology issues, harassment, bullying, improper cell use on campus, those kind of things. So in 2016, they had an incident where they had a sixth grader send a naked picture to another sixth grader, which, as we can all imagine how exciting that day is, went off to the entire campus. I think that they said that they estimated about 70% of the kids had the images by the end of that night. And by the next day, we had about every kid that didn't have a cell phone basically had seen the pictures of this poor girl who had sent it. And they had a safety resource officer come in and write, basically read their juvenile Miranda rights and wrote these kids up for misdemeanor. And in one case, a felony case where one of the kids had distributed over 100 times. So, they called me in and I said, look, let me do this program. Let me have your kids go through this. I believe in them. I think that if they go through this program and they understand here's right and here's wrong, here's what it is. We had, after one presentation, 35% issue with technology infractions after that. And then the following year, last year, it went down to 28%. Simply by telling the kids, here's what you can do and you can't do. And by supporting, I think that the important part there was also supporting the teachers and giving them some guidance in terms of like what it is from an administrative standpoint you can do for them in order to help them make those choices. So I'm in under no mean, yeah, go ahead.
Lisa, going back to that piece of research, were there specific things that brought those statistics down, things that the administrator did or the school did that you remember?
So there was two things that we did. They went through the program, which is that's my program, the Digital Assistant Academy program. So all of the kids in the school in that sixth grade class, sixth, fifth, and fourth grade, they did those three grades, went through that program. And all they did was go in their whiteboard videos. They're not very cumbersome. They're like 10 minutes in length, and they come with a lesson guide where the teachers were also provided keywords and objectives and how to talk about these things, as well as the second part of it was an educational piece for the parents. So that's the part that I think that to me it goes back to, I appreciate your principal so much knowing that they need to have that home support, because once the parents understand what's at risk and what's really happening, and we have the school coming on board and saying, here's the rules that we're going to accept or not accept, and you give the kids that boundary, right? It changes. It's a game changer. So that's what the statistics are from. That's why it drops so much.
And Robin asked a good question that's related to this, that are the parents ever held responsible for infractions with cell phones involving children?
Yes, that's a great question, Robin. One of the issues and one of the things that I talk to parents about is the fact that your child is only, quote unquote, using your device, right? So like if you think about as an adult, as a parent, we are buying and we are writing and signing the contract with those cell phones. So if I have a child who, for instance, puts a threat against the school or does something on their end that is going after something that they could be held liable for, it's actually the parents that are going to be liable for that. So those are the things that I think, again, like in that parent talk that I typically do is I talk about who owns the device. And it's literally the parent. And even if I have parents who say like, well, my child saved up all her birthday money and bought the device, you still sign the contract. And you're still the only one that's on the hook, ultimately, if they make a choice online that puts them or your family literally at risk for that. So that's a great question, Robin. Thank you for asking that. So again, my goal here and why I talk about things is how do we empower our children? How do we empower each other? How do we create an understanding that in a global economy with so many people and so many issues that are facing our kids that have to do with family issues at home, that have to do with the fact that financially they might be struggling, or from an academic standpoint, they're not learning the same way and getting resources for that. That's the part that I feel like from a standpoint of where I am, how do we empower each other to support one another? And I included this quote from Fred Rogers is, anyone who is doing anything for a child to me is a hero. And I want to thank all of the principals that are listening and giving their time, because I truly do feel like you're donating your time, because it is ridiculous to me that we're going to pay professional athletes millions of dollars to go run a ball up and down a field or a court. And the people that are ultimately responsible for our kids are so poorly and underserved in the sense of us giving back to you. So I want to say thank you, because I think that that's really important. And to me, it's about empowering you to understand what you have and what you don't have and be a resource for you and try to help you however I can on my end back. So thank you. And I do see some questions coming in. So Honor, if you want
to. Yeah. Let me,
contact information.
W. Jackson writes, what kind of templates or examples can you give for good social media policies that are out there? What would be some key points you would, want them to stress in the policy?
So that's a great question. And again, I think I've done one privately for a school, but I'm happy to put a template out there if you want to contact me. And write to me and I can clean it up and send it to you. But some of the policies I would encourage you to take as a district or as a school is to say, we as a school don't recommend that your children are involved in situations or places that are going to cause them harm. It is our belief and our experience as a school that these social media platforms that the kids are going into are causing them, can cause unneeded drama or issues on our campus. And we as a school don't support or suggest that you allow your child to be in them. That's the only thing that you can do. Mm-hmm. And the school that I did work with, the PTO, was the one that I specifically came in for, and we created one together. And the PTO sponsored it as kind of an educational piece that didn't come from the district itself. So I don't know if that's helpful at all, because I know that the red tape stuff is not my forte and what you guys face. But so there's certain ways that you can go about it in terms of like informative ways to get your parents the information that they need, but maybe not specifically from a mandate from the school too, if that's too much for you.
Are you able to share any names of districts or resources that are public that you feel would be good things for principals to look at?
Well, I mean, I think on my site itself, Digital Citizen Academy, I have a ton of the AASL, CASAL. I have all of the stuff that you can go in and look at that aligns to the core standards and what they need and what they should be doing. There's a ton of resources out there that I don't know. It seems to me that the district sometimes will kind of pick and choose where they find those resources. And it depends on your state in terms of like what it is. I just went and did a very robust model taking those three standards, and ISTE is one of them too, is make sure that I'm aligned to all of those things so that you're hitting everything that you need to from an administrative level to address it.
Excellent. Con writes, is it wrong for toddlers to see kids' videos on YouTube limited to 2 to 3 hours a day?
So toddlers, anything under the age of two, I absolutely feel is wrong to have any technology time on. And the studies that are on that little pre-K, those little pre-K brains are really frightening to me in the sense that they don't have the neuronal current connections to understand reality versus non-reality. So when you see kids engaging on that, it's really a very surface level engagement. And so the science is starting to come out is showing that those kids end up having a higher chance of not having the ability to authentically connect with others interpersonally later in life. So again, the research is kind of brand new in this area, but the toddler part and the YouTube, if you're using YouTube Premium, possibly, but YouTube is very, very well housed with a lot of people that go in there and place videos of, say, Thomas the Train or Peppa the Pig or any of those Dora the Explorer videos where they'll splice in pornography at 2 to 3 minutes in, and they just basically splice it in so the kid sees it. So as a parent, you might load up Peppa the Pig and think that, okay, they can go watch this for 20 minutes and it gives me a chance to go make dinner. Those predators and those people that get turned on by these like sadistic things will go and watch how many views they get and how many kids they actually get to expose quite literally from a digital sense into those worlds. So I like YouTube to me is trying to do their best to start managing it, but they have millions of videos uploaded every day. And so they just don't have the content oversight that I would ever trust a very young child to look at. Great question.
Excellent. Farah writes, hi, Farah Ferguson here. Today's child is smarter than a parent, and that thing actually makes the parent empower their kids with technology. I feel we need to counsel parents a lot in this regard. What's your input on that?
I think that that's a great comment, Farah. I think that it goes back to what it is that we're smart about and what it is that they're smart about. And I think that, you know, I can't from a standpoint of being the psychologist in the room look at the world today and think that the way that our kids are evolving, with statistics like millennials, I think that over 60% of them don't have a best friend anymore. A lot of them don't have any sort of tie-in or loyalty into positions of their job or their community. And so there's a lot of things that this generation coming up that grew up more on technology are missing. And so as a parent, I worry that we have to give them the reins back and say that these practices that we had growing up are even more important today than ever. And so having those very strict, like in our house, we do Tech Free Tuesday. My kids aren't here, so I can't tell you. When it's a Tuesday and you're listening to this, it's not a Tuesday when I recorded it. But we do those things because I want them to authentically know that they're most important to me on those days. And so giving them examples like that and empowering parents to recognize, to your point, Farah, that they have to be the ones in charge and literally just supporting them and empowering them to make those choices. It's hard. It's hard to be the parent of the only kid that doesn't have technology, but it's important to hold that line.
That's wonderful. Well, we only have a few more minutes. If anyone would like to type in any last remaining questions before we end, thank you so much, Lisa. This has been an excellent webinar, great research, kind of scary. But if any of you have further questions after the webinar is over, this session is being recorded and will be available on our website within 48 hours at www.naesp.org/webinars. It is downloadable if you are a member of NAESP. You'll need to log in. Otherwise, you can download the presentation on that website right now. So again, thank you, Lisa. Any last suggestions for our principal community on what they should go out and do now besides the policy?
I mean, I'm always about sharing and pushing it and paying it forward. So if you can share it as much as you can, the DCAKids.org site is written for parents. So even if you as a school don't have the resources, that's a site that I 100% built because I want the parents to have the tools and the expertise to be able to make better decisions on this stuff. So.
Great. Well, again, Lisa's email address is right down there on the slides. Thank you very much, Lisa, for joining us, and thank you for our audience. Tune in next month, September 11th, for our next webinar Wednesday. Thank you again for joining us, and we will see you next time. Thank you.